Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Killer Psyche ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
A listener note, this episode contains adult content and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised. Good versus evil. For years, the characters in literature and film were filed into one of those two categories, good guys and bad guys. This way of thinking was very black and white. There was no gray area, and characters stayed true to their designation. Of course, not all art was like this. But in the 70s and 80s, a good number of the popular genres, teen films and action films, were scripted with this in mind. But today, the majority of audiences no longer accept people as simply good or evil. Villains are given backstories and character arcs. Heroes are often shown in their least heroic moments, making them complex, more like us, and, well, life in general. After all, that is why I have a podcast and why you are listening, right? When the TV show Batman aired in the mid to late 60s, there was no question about Batman's morality. He would never break a law or act with impropriety. The show was filled with campy villains who wanted to defeat Batman more than they seemed to want to rob a bank. Batman's tragic family history was rarely mentioned, and aside from the occasional two-parters, we knew good would defeat evil before the 30-minute episode ended. Fast forward to recent Batman movies led by Christian Bale, Robert Pattinson, and Ben Affleck. Batman was no longer a hero. He was an anti-hero. He broke the law while doing good. The films were dark, the heroes were moody, and the villains were complicated. Moral ambiguity was rampant. The concepts of right and wrong, not so clear. I bring all this up because as I researched this story, I was shocked how many times I heard the words wicked and evil. Why would I be shocked? Those are fairly common, although not always accurate, descriptions of most killers. Well, most killers are not 11 years old, like the subject of this episode, Mary Bell. And while Mary's crimes were indeed horrific, it would be too simplistic to say she was purely evil. She had a tragic backstory, and she was not one-dimensional, as many others have portrayed her. I say this not as an excuse for her bad acts, but as a reminder that not all stories are black and white. And in the case of Mary Bell, there is a lot of gray. Killer Psyche is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
From Wondery and Treefort, I'm Candace DeLong, and this is the second season of Killer Psyche. I've spent 5 decades studying people's minds through my work as an FBI profiler and psychiatric nurse. I've interviewed lots of murderers, including serial killers. And the question of why they did it is what I get asked time and time again. It is difficult to get a satisfying answer without diving deep into their mindsets. So that's what we're doing. And I will give you my best analysis in this series of what made them do what they did. This episode is Mary Bell. Eleven-year-old Mary Bell had a reputation in her hometown of Scotswood, England. She was known as an angry child. Most children avoided her, except for her next-door neighbor, 13-year-old Norma Bell. Although they had the same last name, they were not related. Norma was a person who many believed had an intellectual disability, while Mary was said to be cunning and sharp. Mary was the leader in their friendship. Scotswood was populated by abandoned buildings and waste grounds, and these are what served as the local children's playground. On May 11, 1968, Mary's 3-year-old cousin claimed he had been playing with Norma and Mary on top of an embankment when someone pushed him. He had a deep laceration on his head, and after Norma and Mary brought him to a local pub for help, it was chalked up to an accident. The incident that occurred the next day, however, could not be ruled an accident. Norma and Mary attacked 3 young girls playing in a sandpit, strangling each of them. When police questioned Norma about the incident, she said, quote, "Mary went to one of the girls and said, 'What happens if you choke someone? Do they die?' Then Mary put both hands round the girl's throat and squeezed. The girl started to go purple. Because of their ages, the police let Mary and Norma off with a warning. However, it was the police who should have been warned. These events were the dreadful foreshadowing of what was to come. 2 weeks later, on May 25th, the day before Mary's 11th birthday, the body of 4-year-old Martin Brown was discovered in a derelict house. His body was surrounded by pill tablets, and other than blood and foam around his mouth, there were no signs of violence. As a local workman attempted to perform CPR on Martin, Norma and Mary appeared in the house watching the workman. They then ran to Martin's aunt to tell her that her nephew was hurt in an accident. Of course, this was no accident. Although it was initially ruled one, it was later discovered that Mary strangled him. That next day, Mary's birthday, the 2 girls broke into a nursery and vandalized it. They also left 4 handwritten notes claiming responsibility for Martin's murder. The notes read, "I murder so that I may come back," and "We did murder Martin Brown. Fuck off, you bastard." The 3rd and 4th notes were similarly vulgar, and the spelling and grammar were somewhat incomprehensible. There is a lot a profiler could tell from these notes. Most importantly, they were written by a juvenile. And that person is screaming out for attention. The police dismissed the notes, believing they were jokes, since the grammar and handwriting was childlike. I can understand their conclusions. It is unfathomable to think that a child could kill deliberately another child. It was almost as unnerving as Mary and Norma appearing at Martin's door 2 days later and asking his mother if they could see him. When his mother replied that he was dead, Mary said, quote, "Oh, I know he's dead. I want to see him in his coffin." 2 months later, on July 31st, 1968, 3-year-old Brian Howe was murdered and left in a wasteland in Scotswood, known as Tin Lizzie. He died of strangulation, and there were post-mortem wounds to his genitals and thighs. His hair was cut in sections, and the initial M was carved into his stomach. Because of the tentativeness with which the cuts were made and the small amount of force used in the murder, the coroner concluded that the suspect was a child. More than 1,200 children were questioned in the investigation, including Norma and Mary Bell. They were playing with Brian shortly before his time of death. Mary told detectives she saw an 8-year-old boy playing with Brian and that he was hitting the child. She also told them she saw the boy had a pair of scissors. Quote, "I saw him trying to cut a cat's tail off with the scissors, but there was something wrong with them. One leg was broken or bent." This alarmed detectives, since they had not released information about scissors to the public. Additionally, the boy she named had a solid alibi. This convinced detectives that Mary was the killer. Now, all they had to do was prove it.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe as ex-homicide detective Roy Freeman. Freeman is forced to piece together the brutal evidence from a decade-old murder investigation. With only instincts to trust, he faces a chilling truth. Sometimes it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. I'm really looking forward to this movie. I have interviewed some people that had a fractured mind regarding traumatic events. This is going to be good. Watch Sleeping Dogs now on digital on sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. Killer Psyche is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up for spring, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Whether you thrive around people or you prefer some more alone time, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that does not drain your battery. Your therapist can help you identify triggers and appropriate coping mechanisms so you can continue to build helpful habits. Plus, therapy can be beneficial for everyone, not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/psyche today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/psyche. Mary Flora Bell was born on May 26, 1957, in Northumberland, England, to Betty and Billy Bell. Betty was a sex worker who specialized in sadomasochism as a dominatrix. Billy was a known criminal and armed robber who was frequently incarcerated. It is unknown if Billy was Mary's biological father. He married Betty when she was 17 and Mary was an infant. A baby was not something Betty wanted. In the first 4 years of Mary's life, Betty tried to get rid of Mary multiple times, either by giving her away or trying to kill her. In fact, the first thing Betty reportedly said when newly born Mary was handed to her was, "Take that thing away from me." The fact that she referred to her daughter as a thing, well, what does that mean? It depersonalizes the infant. It's not a person. It's not a he or a she. It's a thing. Do things have feelings? Do things need their mommy? No, they don't. When Mary was a year old, she was rushed to the hospital after overdosing on her grandmother's headache medication. Medication that was hidden away and impossible to reach, or impossible for a one-year-old to even open. A year and a half later, in November of 1959, Betty gave Mary to some friends who frequently asked to adopt her. When Betty's sister found out, she made the friends return Mary to her mother, and she asked Betty if she could take care of her niece. But Betty refused. By this time, Mary also had a brother. 6 months later, the siblings were saved from another potentially fatal overdose by their aunt, who discovered the children on the floor with Drinamil pills all around. She rushed them to the hospital. Drinamil, known in the United States as Dexamil, was marketed as a weight loss and antidepressant medication. In fact, it was an early form of amphetamine. Betty maintained that the children stole the bottle out of her handbag and took all the pills. Mary's aunt became even more worried for her niece and nephew's safety. She and her husband once again offered to keep them, not to adopt, since they thought that would make it easier for Betty to say yes. But once again, Betty refused. You may ask yourself, well, if Betty didn't want the kids, and she obviously did not, why wouldn't she just give them to a loving and willing relative? The answer to that question will become more clear as we get into this episode. I will simply say at this juncture, I think Betty enjoyed abusing her children. She got something out of it, and that's why she kept them. In the summer of 1960, Mary visited her grandmother in Glasgow. Her grandmother's flat was on the third floor, and the bathrooms were on the first, so the family would occasionally let the young children relieve themselves in the sink. Next to the sink was a window, so an adult needed to be present when the children used it as a toilet so they would not fall out. Betty was holding Mary above the sink one day when suddenly another relative saw Mary falling out of the window.
He raced across the room and was able to grab the girl by her ankles and save her. A few days after the window accident, amid growing alarm about the kid's welfare, another relative followed Betty when she took Mary out for a walk. Betty took Mary to an adoption agency. There, she tried to give her daughter to a woman who was moving to Australia. She had been denied her application to adopt a child, but she ran into Betty on the way out, and Betty gave Mary to her. The relative alerted Betty's mother, who warned her that if she did not have Mary back home in 2 hours, she was calling the police. Betty quickly retrieved Mary and brought her back. It's hard to say how different Mary's life might have been had she been adopted or if Betty's family called the police on her. But I think there's a good chance we would not be talking about her on Killer Psyche. 6 months later, the situation worsened. Mary was hospitalized for 3 months after her mother fed her iron pills, telling her they were candy. When a sister confronted Betty, a huge fight ensued, and Betty stopped speaking with her family altogether. That was the last of Mary's so-called accidents. But what happened after that was even worse. Billy, who was for all intents and purposes Mary's dad, was frequently incarcerated and consistently absent from home. When he was around, Mary was somewhat protected, but that was not often. Starting at the age of only 4, Betty left Mary at the houses of older men to look after her, when in fact they were molesting her. When Mary was 5, Betty began to make her watch as she entertained her clients. She forced Mary to participate in oral sex with her clients, telling her young daughter that no one would believe her if she told, and if they did, they would send her to jail. Mary was terrified. Her mother allowed men to torture and sexually assault her. After Mary was abused, her mother would give her treats and be affectionate with her. It was her reward for servicing her mother's clients. Mary recalls that time as feeling loved. Not surprisingly, Mary frequently wet the bed, if you could call it a bed. It was a bare mattress and an old coat that served as a blanket. When she wet the bed, her mother rubbed her face in the urine and made her put the wet mattress in the window so the neighbors would know that Mary had wet the bed. Mary's younger brother became the target of Betty's anger as well, and Betty frequently beat him. When Mary was only 8 years old, she began charging older men to have her watch them masturbate. She approached their cars and got inside, then blackmailed them with threats unless they paid her. Her mother abandoned Mary and her brother, leaving them alone for weeks at a time to fend for themselves for food and clothing. When she returned, the abuse resumed as well. Police were called when, after Mary accidentally used all the hot water for a bath, Betty attempted to drown her in a cold tub. After Mary escaped, Betty beat her and her brother with a dog chain. Betty told the police that nothing happened, and they left. When she returned, the abuse continued. Mary was acting out at school as well. In addition to the events I described earlier, Mary was once accused of suffocating a girl by pouring sand down her throat. When classmates described Mary's outbursts, they said her head would begin to shake and her eyes would become blank, like a gaze of steel. There has been speculation that these were seizures and that they were caused by epilepsy. While a correlation between epileptic seizures and aggression has been debated for years, there is no scientific data that proves this. In fact, recent studies have found that epilepsy itself does not play a role in violent behavior. There are some individuals who act aggressively between seizures. These periods of time are known as interictal. According to the Epilepsy Foundation, quote, there are syndromes of interictal behavior changes that can occur in people with epilepsy. They go on to say, the idea of such interictal behavior disorders remains a controversial subject, but certain behaviors have been recognized as part of the interictal behavior's profile in many cases. Some suggest that aggression should be part of this behavioral profile. Linking epilepsy with aggression has contributed to the stigma of the disorder. So any work that clarifies the nature of the relationship between these two factors has many potential benefits. While we don't know if Mary had epilepsy, no other indications or symptoms were mentioned, so I believe it was highly unlikely. Mary's violent behavior could also have stemmed from intermittent explosive disorder, or possibly a rage attack. Intermittent explosive disorder is a condition characterized by sudden outbursts of violence, aggression, and rage. I've seen it. It's scary. These reactions are disproportionate to the situation, or they're simply irrational. IED, as it is also known by, is one of several impulse control disorders, and most people who have this disorder also have another mental health condition, high anxiety and bipolar disorders being among the most common. A rage attack is also a sudden, out-of-control burst of anger. But according to Cedars-Sinai, they are more about the release of pent-up tension than achieving a specific goal. The problem I have with these two possibilities is that Mary's attacks were not necessarily an explosion of anger. Though she might have been rageful, I'm not certain that she was out of control. Here's the thing. People sometimes forget that Mary was a child. Yes, that is what drew so much attention to the case initially. It was hard for most people to comprehend that a young person could do something so morally reprehensible. And let me be clear, what she did was beyond horrific. She took the lives of two little boys and destroyed their families' lives forever. But to understand her actions, we have to look at the history of abuse and neglect she endured. We also need to take into account her age at the time of the murders. Many courts consider someone guilty if they understand the difference between right and wrong, or if they understand their behavior was a crime. But to be held criminally responsible, most courts require that suspects understand various other factors, most of which children do not fully comprehend. Research conducted on this very topic details that, quote, child murderers don't fully understand the severity or implications of their crimes. During the investigation into the murders and following her release from prison, Mary said on several occasions that she did not understand the finality of death. And that makes sense. She was young, very young, and no one close to her had died at that point in her life. Death is a concept that is hard to understand at any age, but especially as an 11-year-old. Children learn from their parents, and they understand certain behaviors are right and wrong, but maybe not the reasons why. Like the concept of death, morality is also very abstract and hard for children to understand. According to Swiss psychologist Jean Piaget, a specialist in child development, quote, most children under 12 are only able to reason and solve problems using ideas that can be represented concretely. It is not until puberty that the ability to reason with abstract concepts, like thinking about hypothetical situations, develops. Prepubescent children are also not fully emotionally developed and less able to use self-control and appreciate the consequences of their actions. This, in combination with the fact that many child murderers are impulsive, aggressive, and unable to deal with their emotions, suggests that when children kill, they are treating their victim as a target, as an outlet for violence. It is extremely rare for a child to kill another child. In fact, a statistic from the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention reveals less than 2% of child murders in the United States are committed by other children. York University psychology professor Robert T. Mueller says child killer cases tend to be significantly different from one another, making conclusions difficult to reach. However, he notes some similarities in child killers have emerged, which shine some light on the minds and behaviors of young children who commit murder. It is not surprising that children who murder have been abused, neglected, or experienced a tumultuous home life. One result of that abuse and neglect can be something called attachment disorder. Attachment disorder is a condition that makes it difficult or impossible for some kids to develop a deep emotional connection with their parent or primary caregiver. In some cases, the child may not be able to establish that connection, which is known as the attachment bond, at all. Psychologist Terry M. Levy of the Evergreen Psychotherapy Center in Colorado notes that children who have severe attachment problems and a history of abuse may develop very aggressive behaviors. They can also have a lot of trouble controlling their emotions, and that can lead to impulsive, violent outbursts directed at themselves or others. And that might explain Mary's seizure-like episodes. And there are several additional similarities among child murderers, such as witnessing or experiencing violence, suffering a traumatic loss, or being rejected or abandoned by a parent. Other similarities include having a family member with a criminal record, as well as having a history of disruptive behavior. Mary Bell's home life checked every single box on that list. Problems in the home can be particularly influential. If a child witnesses or experiences violence, including sex abuse, they are likely to repeat that same violence in other situations. I think it's a wonder that Mary survived her mother at all. When a child is hurt, it is common to view the perpetrators as depraved monsters. But what happens when the perpetrator is also a child? Well, it is not as straightforward, especially when the child goes to court to face charges. And when Mary's trial began, the story became even more complicated.
Looking for a fun and relaxing way to unwind? Download Two Dots, the free puzzle game with over 5,000 unique levels. Connect dots to solve colorful puzzles and collect rewards. With different gameplay modes like scavenger hunt and arcade, there's always a new adventure. Don't want a game alone? Connect and engage with the larger Two Dots community to match up your skills. If you're looking for the perfect game to help you relax but also keep you engaged, download Two Dots for free on Android and iOS.
As police closed in on Mary and Norma, their interviews with the two girls revealed more and more inconsistencies. Finally, in Norma's fourth interview on August 4th, 1968, she confessed to police that she had witnessed Mary strangle Brian Howe. Mary was arrested, and upon further investigation, detectives made a connection to Martin Brown's death as well. They discovered Mary's drawing of Martin's crime scene, with details included that had never been released to the public. They were also able to compare Mary's handwriting with the notes left when the nursery was vandalized. On December 5, 1968, the trial for the murders of Brian and Martin began. Mary and Norma were accused of killing, quote, solely for the pleasure and excitement of murder. That's a bit of a leap for a prosecutor to say that. Neither girl ever said to the police or anyone else that they did it for pleasure and that it excited them. During the trial, Mary showed no emotion in court, and she paid very close attention to the proceedings. Psychiatrists who examined her said Mary displayed psychopathic tendencies. However, Norma was very emotional and portrayed as the victim of Mary's manipulation. And 9 days later, Norma was acquitted for that exact reason. Mary was convicted of manslaughter for the death of both boys. She was seen as having what is called diminished responsibility because they believe she displayed symptoms of psychopathy, meaning she was a psychopath, at 10 years old. According to today's DSM-5, an individual cannot be diagnosed a psychopath or sociopath or antisocial personality disorder until they are at least 18 years old and have a long-established pattern of disregarding the rights of others. The judge believed Mary should be sent to a psychiatric hospital where she would receive proper care. But there were no available beds for adolescents her age in all of England. At the verdict, Mary cried. Despite being extremely disruptive in court and frequently storming out, Mary's mother, Betty, put her hands to her face and sobbed. Betty later told her daughter, "No one could be as bad as she was, and no one felt any compassion for her." In 1968, Mary was sentenced to the reform school, Red Bank. There, she was the only girl among 20 boys. Though Mary's life finally had structure and support, she reported in 1970 that a teacher at the school had molested her. She began cutting herself. Cutting oneself is not at all uncommon. In my many years working in clinical psychiatry, I saw many patients who had scars on their arms from cutting themselves, or sometimes we would find them on the unit, hiding in a closet or locking themselves in the bathroom and cutting themselves with anything they could find that was sharp. More than one patient told me the reason they did it was the momentary pain from the cutting distracted them from their horrible thoughts or their horrible feelings. Even though it was self-destructive and it was only momentary, it was a relief. After a brief stay in the hospital, Mary became even more focused on securing her freedom. Meanwhile, Mary's mother continued to victimize her. Betty would sell her daughter's private letters and poems to the newspapers. And some of the letters were completely fictitious. Betty wrote them herself. She continued to exploit Mary by taking pictures of her in her underwear and showing them to the press, all the while continuing to push the narrative that she was only interested in doing what was right for her daughter. Well, Betty is not exactly in line for Mother of the Year. In fact, I believe the wrong person went to prison. Don't you? As Mary's body matured, she separated herself more and more from the boys at the school. Given that she had not committed one violent act since she had been there, and she was excelling at school, the staff at Red Bank were preparing her to transition out of detention and into everyday society. But things did not go as planned for Mary. And despite her best efforts, at the age of 16, she was transferred to an all-female open prison for women. There, she was frequently in solitary confinement twice for attempting suicide. Her crime? She apparently bled on government property. When Mary was 20 years old, she escaped from prison but was quickly recaptured. Mary was finally released from prison and granted anonymity in 1980. She was 23 years old. 4 years later, at the age of 27, she gave birth to a daughter. When her daughter was 4, Mary's identity became revealed, and the other parents at her child's school petitioned for the child to be excluded. In 1998, after moving and changing identities more than 5 times, the press found her and revealed her now 14-year-old daughter's identity. In 2003, after years of being pursued by the media, Mary won lifelong anonymity granted by the High Court for herself and her daughter, and also for her granddaughter, who was born in 2009. Lifelong anonymity is granted for adults who were convicted of crimes as children. These orders legally prevent a person ever being identified. Because of this, we have no idea of Mary's current whereabouts. Mary Bell is now 66 years old and living in obscurity.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Killer Psyche ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. I'm your host, Candace DeLong. This episode was written and produced by Lisa Ammerman and Julie Burke. Story research and additional writing by Ann Liu. Mix and sound design by Joshua Morales. Senior audio producer, Maxwell Carney. Head of audio, Tom Monahan. Renee Levesque is our production manager. Lindsay Whistler, Colin Modell, and Jada Williams, our production assistants. Oscar Guido is the producer from Treefort Media. From Amazon Music and Wondery, the producer is Stephanie Joaquin. And the co-executive producer is Julie Burke. Lastly, our executive producers are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman for Treefort, and Marshall Louie and Aaron O'Flaherty for Wondery. The series is produced by Wondery and Treefort Media.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.